Remember me, though I have to say goodbye. Remember me, don't let it make you cry. For even if I'm far away, I hold you in my heart. I sing a secret song to you each night we are apart. Remember me, though have to travel far. Remember me each time you hear a sad guitar. Know that I'm with you the only way that I can be, until you're in my arms again. Remember me. Recuérdame.
Memories and keepsakes for this Memorial Day weekend. What gets left to us and why we keep it. Coming up in this hour to Stay Human.
Our love alive, I'll never fade away. If you close your eyes and let the music play, keep our love alive, I'll never fade away. If you close your eyes and let the music play, keep our love alive, I'll never fade away.
That song is from the movie Coco, about the Day of the Dead. All the music from the movie is written by Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez. I'm Michael Goldberg. I'm pleased to share with you some more great music and some wonderful stories from local writers in this hour. A ball game, an oil portrait, a garden, a lifetime of paths remembered and cherished. What's been left to us? We start with a miniature toolkit. My friend Caleb Leinbach received this when he was 9 years old. It was left to him by Grandpa Gus.
Grandpa Gus was something special. I don't know. Maybe it was because he passed at a younger age, that you have the memory of a greater person than they necessarily were, but in my mind, he was pretty special. I remember being at a young age, going fishing, just enjoying the little things in life, enjoying nature, being nice, seeing him with all these people and kids, because they came from he was a science teacher in Ann Arbor, Michigan. But then they also ran camps in the summer, one called Innisfree in the lower peninsula of Michigan, right on near the Sand Bear Dunes, which a lot of people are familiar with. And then they also owned Crystal Air, which was also where my mother was born, in Frankfurt. And just seeing him deal with all these different people from around the world, you know, of all colors, of all religions, of all... And not even knowing that at that age, I guess, that he was doing that, but just seeing it and looking at people for the individual that they were. And when he passed, I remember Father traveling with my little brother Gus, who was 6.5 years younger, just so he could get to meet his namesake. And it was around Christmas time, and me and Mom went down and took the Greyhound bus from Bemidji to Traverse City, Michigan. And I remember my father picking us up and going seeing Grandpa Gus, who I had not seen for about a year. And he'd been suffering from cancer for some time. And he was pretty frail. And I remember that being one of the first deaths I've dealt with. And he passed away the day after Christmas. And shortly after, we all went up to the dunes by Lake Michigan and spread his ashes and... Good day that was. And that night, we all got together in their house in the living room. And at the time, it was just the 4 grandkids. Now there are 5 more since his death. But it was me, my little brother Gus, my cousin Jason, and my cousin Brent. I can't remember what Jason or Gus got. I do remember Brent got a, I believe, a butterfly, like encased in a case.
And I remember Grandma Paula handed me this little black booklet with a zipper on it, and opening it up and loving the little toolbox because it was a little knife that I could have, or a little handle, I should say, that you had switch parts. One hammer, one saw, one knife, a screwdriver, something you could do with everything. And I remember reading the note, and I remember it being nice. But the instrument itself was much cooler. And then years go by, and it sits in a drawer. Then you open it up again, and you, teens probably, was the first time I saw it again after a long time. And I think some pieces have gone missing, but I gathered them, got them all back together. And then reading that note again. This is what the note said. Caleb, Gus kept this toolkit to fix the little problems that popped in the house. He'd rather spend his time with people problems, but both kinds of fixers are much needed. But he knew that you already had that ability to make people feel good about themselves. The last time I used it was a hummingbird feeder that I was putting up recently, actually. Because I needed to chop this little piece of plastic off, and it has this perfect saw that works on those tiny little things to this day.
That's Caleb Leinbach of Black Duck, and to this day, he still is both kinds of fixers. It heartens me to know that Caleb still uses that little toolkit his grandfather left him. Sometimes you get left something from your childhood that you just don't know what to do with. Storyteller Sue Searing gives us this, her story called My Sister's Portrait.
Before my wife and I moved to Minnesota, we sold or gave away a lot of stuff we wouldn't need in our new home. But after moving, we realized that we could do without a lot of the stuff we had brought with us. It was time for another round of purging, all in preparation for the great downsizing that is somewhere in our future. But shedding stuff isn't easy. Every object seems to evoke a cherished memory. So to help us through this process, we joined a decluttering support group. And as the members shared strategies for transitioning from their big family homes to small apartments, or dealing with the objects passed down from earlier generations, I was reminded of the days following my mother's death, when it fell to my two younger sisters and me to clear out the big old Victorian house that our parents bought in 1952 and filled up with stuff for half a century. We all lived in other states, in our own fully furnished dwellings, so we agreed. Most of the stuff in our childhood home, furniture, dishes, antiques, could all simply be auctioned off. Of course, we each picked out a few sentimental items to keep. I pointed to the large picture above the telephone table in the living room and said to my sister Nora, "You're taking that, right?" "Ew, no," she said, "I hate that picture." Her reaction surprised me because it was a portrait of her, painted in oils by our grandmother. In it, Nora looks about 6 years old, in a blue dress with puffed sleeves and a white pleated collar. Long blonde hair tumbles about her face, and she looks directly at the viewer with large blue eyes and rosebud lips. "It doesn't even look like me," Nora said. And it's true. Her hair was never that thick or wavy. Her eyes aren't that large and expressive. And she almost never wore a frilly dress. "Well, yeah," I said, "but you know Grandma always idealized her subjects." "And besides," Nora went on, "I just wanted to play outside, and she made me stay indoors and pose for her." Ah, yes. Sitting still while Grandma painted or sketched us was an ordeal all of her grandkids had to endure at some point. Well, if Nora felt that strongly about the painting, I didn't want it either, and neither did our youngest sister. We consigned it to the estate auction. I wasn't there when the auction took place, but I heard later that some of Mom's friends attended it. We had made a mistake. Mom hadn't left any particular bequests, so we should have invited her close friends to go through the house and take what they wanted. Things might have turned out differently. I got a call from Mom's friend Doris. "Oh, Sue," she said, "you girls must have been so distraught by Jean's death. Somehow that beautiful portrait of her ended up in the auction. I know you'd never part with it, so I bought it to give back to you." "Doris," I said, "that isn't Mom's portrait. It's Nora." "Oh, no, it's your mother. Her mother painted it when Jean was a little girl." I tried to set her straight, but she insisted that Mom had told her this. Finally, I gave up arguing. "Listen, Doris, you were such a good friend to Mom in her final years. Why don't you keep the picture? I think she'd want you to have it." Well, several years passed. Then, out of the blue, I got a letter from Doris. "Dear Sue, I have loved having your mother's portrait hanging in my house. I look at it every day and remember my dear friend. But we're downsizing, and the time has come for me to let her go. If you want it back, I will mail it to you." Oh, dear. Doris already thought I was a flaky daughter who accidentally abandoned a precious family memento. But if I refused the portrait now, she'd think I was a heartless daughter. I wrote back and thanked her and promised to pay for the postage. Soon the portrait was back in my possession. I emailed Nora. "Hey, sis, remember Grandma's painting of you? I've got it. Have you changed your mind?" "No," she wrote back. "I never want to see that painting again." I thought I really ought to just throw it out. But somehow I couldn't toss Grandma's work in the trash can. So I stashed it in a closet. I found it again as we prepared to move to Minnesota. I thought, maybe I should put it in the yard sale. Someone might buy it just for the frame. But I couldn't do that either. So the portrait came with me to the Twin Cities. As I unpacked it, I considered whether the time had come to hang it on the wall. But it's so clearly the work of an amateur, and it doesn't look anything like my sister. So I tucked it away in the back of another closet. In the decluttering support group, we talked about problem objects, the ones we have no rational reason for holding on to but just can't let go of. The standard advice was to take a picture of it. Then you'll have the memory and you can let the object go. So I took a picture of the picture, but that wasn't satisfactory. I realized that what gives an object meaning for me isn't a picture, but the story behind it. So I told the support group the story of the painting that wouldn't let me get rid of it. And later, I told some other people. And now I want to keep the painting, because it's no longer just part of the background scenery from my childhood. It's got some stories attached. I look at it, and I think of my grandma, who began painting at about the same age that I took up storytelling. Two late-blooming artists. I look at it, and I think about my sister, Nora, who wanted to run free outdoors and was forced to sit quietly. She hasn't changed. I look at it and feel the depth of my mother's and Doris's friendship. It's not a very good painting, and it doesn't look anything like my sister, but it's not in the back of the closet anymore. It's hanging in my study, and every time I see it, I smile.
Sure.
Sue Searing is a frequent contributor to Stay Human, as is our next teller, poet Robert Jevney. He's begun to think about what he might leave behind.
To my artistic wife, when I am done and gone and you have decided finally to make something of my life, some artifact or testament, please be sure to use up that bucket of bent nails. Also, there are several plastic drawers full of screws, small bolts, mismatched nuts and washers. There's a pile of curved, twisted boards in the shed, too crooked for any practical purpose, that I simply could not throw away on my own. There's a box of outdated light bulbs, spent batteries of various sizes and purpose, and components from any number of entertainment devices through the years. Maybe I should teach you how to weld, as there's quite a bit of rusted chain under one of the shop tables, and scrap metal pieces, hammerheads, overfiled chainsaw chains, spools of fencing wire, both electric and barbed, speaker wire, stranded cable. Watch out for those frayed ends. Plenty of short and or kinked lengths of electric cable and some slightly rotten baling twine. Don't forget the plumbing parts, used copper tubing, discarded faucets and drains, and several sizes and types of unions. The rest of it you can sell or give away. Someone like me will probably want it. I'd hate to see it go to waste. As far as the piece goes, put it in the far corner outside the field amongst that pile of stones near the river. It seems fitting. Then burn all the papers and scatter the ashes. Sell the house. Move away from here. Move closer to the kids. Have them think kindly of me sometimes, but don't dwell. I'll be fine.
That's Robert Jevney. A Piano Prelude by Nino Rota. You can hear all kinds of music on these airwaves. Stay tuned at 6 o'clock for Jazz on America Avenue. Northern Community Radio's program service is supported by the financial contributions of our listener members. If you're not a member, please join us. We also receive support for this and other local programs from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. That fund was established by the Legacy Amendment to our state constitution, mostly for making sure we can pass on the legacy of our waters and lands in as good or better condition than we received them. But the fund also includes some to help make sure our stories get told. Both kinds are essential to the future. Thank you to Minnesota's voters for knowing that so. Today on Stay Human, we're hearing about legacies, what gets passed on. Later in this hour, I want to tell you for Memorial Day something about an afternoon I spent in World War II. But this Memorial Day, and really any day is the right time, we celebrate what's been left to us. I know a lucky few folks who can do that every time they step outside onto land that they were born on. Most everyone has objects, a diary, a clock, the old lantern Grandpa got working in the mine. And all of us have stories, our own and the ones we've been told. These things and these memories, when we finger them again, connect and ground us. Sometimes what's left to us is as fleeting and as ever-renewing as a garden. Up next, Sue Hawkinson shares a poem she wrote called Tender Heart, but I asked her first to tell us about the friend she wrote it for.
My good friend Ed Subcheck died February 1st of this year. He was 86 years old, and we'd been friends for about 16 years when I moved on the lake where he had a summer cabin. And I learned a lot about the flora and fauna from him. He was an amazing man. At 84, he was still splitting wood, stacking it, and burning it in his cabin the way any 40-year-old man would. He'd come up in the winter, and he would stoke up the fire, and then he'd get his sled, and he'd carry his auger and all of his fishing gear out to the lake, and he'd sit on his pail, and he'd fish. So I'd come out, go down the hill in my skis, and go out and visit with him while he fished. And if he caught two tilapias, then he just says, "I'm satisfied." And he'd go up, and he'd have a fish fry that night. He was one of these guys who was always giving me like the phenology report for the neighborhood. He'd tell me what he saw in the morning when he'd come over for coffee. But we never made plans. If he showed up and I could make coffee for him, then it was a go. Otherwise, we just didn't get together. But we'd talk about the deer. We'd talk about the fox. He would trap raccoons. And I was grateful for that. I quit growing corn, which helped quite a bit, but they were really pests with the corn. He was a man who had a garden in town. He lived in Coleraine most of the time, and his garden was big enough that he could harvest 20 pounds of peas and bring it to the food shelf. So everybody got to have fresh produce, not just those who grew it. And he was a man who kept in shape all of these years, and so he was able to take his friends out fishing, or he'd go over every morning and have coffee with his buddy, called her Sody. I think it's Florence Soderbergh, and she'd have a cookie and coffee for him. And then he'd go out on his morning route, and he'd spend an hour picking up garbage, and that was his morning walk in Coleraine. And so he helped keep the city clean. And what he said about that was he really thought it helped people become more conscious of what they were throwing out the window. And so he was one of these kind of citizens that always was doing something to help another person. And I was so admiring of that. Tender Heart, a tribute to Ed Subcheck. My neighbor tells me that I suffer from a tender heart. Young seedlings muscle through my garden rows, almost too thick to grow. I nurse these fragile sprouts, green to the ways of gardening, while my neighbor starts thinning not long after planting. Some years he presses peas into the soil before the end of March. If April showers instead of snows, they'll flower. When they fruit, he boils the pods, slides each one between his teeth to eat the sweet young peas, then leaves the pods outdoors for foraging deer and fox. Ed eats beets weeks before I do, having pulled the sprouts to clear the space each beet needs for its portly purple waste. He gives away more than he eats, doesn't can or freeze. Content with this year's crop, he waits for next spring's equinox when he stops by to let me know, whistling below my kitchen window, "Susie, Susie, Susie." Tender heart, time to think of planting seeds.
Susan Hawkinson. Thank you. music from the Danish String Quartet. We've been hearing this hour about some things and stories that connect us to the past and show us a path forward. I recently read a letter about paths written by Irene Whitmark Kyle, who celebrates her birthday this week. All her life, she has written letters to her children, and one of those children is my friend, Anita Norden, in Bemidji. I called Anita to ask if she would read her mom's letter on this program, and she said, "It's funny you should call right now. I just printed out a copy to include with a graduation card to send to my niece's son, a letter from his great-grandmother."
This particular letter I have carried around in my wallet for a long time. I don't have a date on it, and I would think that it probably has been in my wallet for about 20 years. And Mom is going to be turning 97 on the 28th of May. So she was obviously retired. She is a school teacher and taught at rural schools. And she taught at Nebish until it closed down, and they went to Black Duck. And then after that, she went to Pinewood, and it was a one-room school where she taught all of the grades. So I pulled this out of my wallet not very long ago, and it's been creased to the point where I thought, if I don't take a picture of this and save it, I don't know how many of my siblings would have saved it. So I thought, well, I'll take a picture. And then we ended up, you know, putting it on so other people could read it. And this one, this letter is called Paths Long Remembered. And I'll read it now. "Before my remembering, my parents kept a cowbell tied on my back with crisscrossed straps to the front. I do remember the first long path through woods, across the bog, a bit of a road, to our school of 11 pupils, 3.5 miles away. At age 7.5, to be able to walk to school, it is no wonder I wanted school to last forever. Years later, Mother told me she'd cry as I left each morning. Ah, but once a blizzard came, and here was this team, Maud and Queen, our horses, and wagon coming to get me, oblivious of any danger. My two pet crows would meet me, one on each shoulder. Stepped on a partridge, stumbled and fell on a baby skunk. Had a trap line and a father who skinned the animals and gave me the profit for my gum. Moving to Grand Rapids, suburbia blocked out my woods, and I promptly got hopelessly lost in the grid of cement sidewalks. For sidewalks never show the path to stay on, and I often strayed. I was back to the country at Elmwood, Elida, when a junior in high school. Now paths were to the neighbors, picking berries and identifying all trees, plants, and weeds. At Bemidji State College, paths were through halls up to the courthouse to work. No cars, so we walked and walked, and our calf muscles of our legs bulged and bulged. Teaching, back to woods and Indian Village. Paths were to the lake, food to the cemetery, to maple sugaring, and in summer to the homes on paths up to 5 miles out. The years of marriage in Hallock were filled with paths uptown to the town hall, to Wass's, to our church and chasing the little ones. Many stairs, including the one out our back door, over the roof and down to our backyard. In returning to Bemidji and teaching in a country school, paths were nature hikes, picnics, softball, skating rinks, around and around. We moved to here where we now live. Aunt Irene and I brushed out miles of paths to Bootleg Lake and home from school, a way we would trudge down one of the many paths. Last summer's vacation had a path, not a road, across the flats of the dike. 6:30 a.m. found us hiking and me gathering round white rocks. Now I'm not sure if it was the walk I enjoyed or the path, mountains on three sides of us, no woods. Rain, snow, drizzle, sun, wind, and oh, the fog, something ethereal about following a path in heavy fog. I wonder if sometimes people wander through life like that. If you really think about it, life is a path and not always a straightforward one. Sometimes we realize we're on the wrong path and have to make a turn back. If perchance a wrong path is taken, you darn well will soon know it. May all your paths be happy. With respect for your paths, Grandma Kyle. And then she writes at the bottom a definition of path: a way beaten by the feet of man or beast, a way or passage, course of life. She kept files for every child, and in those files are sayings, things that she would cut out, things that meant a lot to her. Every letter that we had written home, every card that we had written to them, every postcard that we had sent, along with newspaper clippings of whatever reason somebody or one of us was in the paper. And to be able to go back through those things, not everybody is a keeper like that. But, boy, it's good to have things like that to look back at.
Thanks to Nita Norton for sharing that legacy, and happy birthday, Irene. Sometimes you might inherit something down through the generations that it's time to stop passing along to the next. Here's Matthew Miltich.
Spare the rod. Corporal punishment, they called it. At the Roman Catholic parochial school I attended, first grade through eighth, and they employed it. The Benedictine nuns who tried to teach me there when I was little used it creatively. I resisted them. I got in trouble a lot and felt the sting of a wooden ruler whacked across the tops of my child's fingers and a leather strap lashed across my tender bottom. A dreamer, the nuns called me, a kid often lost in his own thoughts, who refused their lessons, one who couldn't resist a one-liner that cracked up the other kids when sister said something I couldn't resist countering with a joke. I nearly learned one clear lesson they taught by their own example: to punish with physical violence the body of one who offends you. But from this legacy, in a moment of epiphany one day when I was in my middle 20s, I escaped. Spare the rod and spoil the child. I heard this Catholic truism from the priest in his homily at Mass on Sunday, as there before us the crucified Christ in plaster replica hung in bloody torture on a wooden cross above the altar. My father, a faithful Catholic from an immigrant family, one of 10 children, and himself the father of 10, heard the priest's words and believed them. His own father, he said, when he and his brothers had offended the old man, used a razor strop on them. "You're lucky," our father told us. He who used his trousers belt of genuine alligator leather to punish my brothers and me by strapping us across our bare little bottoms when we'd done something that was to him or to our mother truly egregious, or when he lost his temper at us. "I'm not as hard on you as my father was on me. It didn't feel lucky." My mother was tender-hearted and could never bring herself to punish us so, but "just wait till your father gets home," she told us, when one or some or all of us had gone too far. My father's temper could be very sweet when all was well, but our mother's words of warning chilled us, because when our old man was confronted with our mother's reports of our misdeeds, if he lost his temper, which he was prone to do when warned from his day's work, we were in for it. Unhappy in school and about school from first grade to 12th, unable to comprehend why the adult world insisted I be educated in the fashion in which my schooling was thrust upon me all those years, as soon as I was 18, I joined the U.S. Marine Corps. I wonder still at what desperate motive could provoke a tender, good-hearted, small-town kid like me to join voluntarily that fighting force during the war then being waged by our country. 6 months after my induction into the Marines, I was in the fight in South Vietnam. Some years later, as a young father, I find myself fighting to save my marriage of 5 years to the mother of my own two beautiful kids, a boy just shy of 3 years old and a girl not yet five. My then wife has decided she no longer wants a life with me in northern Minnesota, is no longer committed to the day-to-day care of our children. I'm with her in Bay Area, California, where we've agreed to a temporary truce. It's not going well. It's afternoon. My little girl has done something that's angered me. What can it be? So small, so insignificant her offense is, it's lost to my memory. But anyway, I'm suddenly out of control, ambushed by rage. I have her in hand, and I'm about to swat her little bottom with my open right hand, so large and strong, and she so small and fragile, when all at once I see not my sweet little daughter and my own raised hand, but from my own childhood, my father, just minutes home from work, worn and tired, and my mother, equally ravaged by her day's care of our house and her unruly kids, as she confronts him with the day's chaos of her life at home with their kids. I see it in his face. He wants only to be left in peace, to eat his supper, to recover from his labors. Instead, my mother requires him at once to discipline their flock of children in ways she cannot or will not. Spare the rod and spoil the child. I see his weariness erupt suddenly into rage, and he comes for me. This vision appears to me in my own anger now that I am myself a father, about to punish this child of my own. I understand now. The old man is upset with my mother for hitting him with her report of their child's misdeeds, and this ignites his anger, composed of who knows how many private frustrations of his own, which now is about to explode into violent punishment of his child. He's not mad at me. He's mad at my mom. But he can't hit her. In his code of right behavior, a man must never hit a woman, but he must discipline his kids. Do I have it right, this new understanding of my own mother and father? I don't know exactly, but I know certainly and suddenly I'm not truly angry with my own child, no, but with my circumstances and with her mother. Like my father, I will never hit a woman, but also I have no right ever to strike a child. The light of this prehension pierces me. My duty as a father is not to punish the body of my child, but to protect it. So I'm stopped suddenly, and I fold my little daughter into my arms, and that finishes it. A legacy of violence against children, which I might have furthered. My brothers and sisters, spare the rod and love the child.
Rodrigo y Gabriela from their newest release. Memorial Day didn't become a national holiday until 1972. For more than 100 years before that, it had been a national practice, always on the 30th of May, to lay flowers at the graves of those who died in war. Fresh flowers every year, more graves with every generation. Around when Memorial Day became an official national holiday, Congress passed the Uniform Monday Holiday Observance Act that threw out dates like May 30th or Washington's actual birthday and said, it's always on a Monday, let's have more long weekends. And though the flags will fly at half mast tomorrow morning, it does seem that the day's purpose is eclipsed by the picnics and softball games, the long weekend for play and chores. Writer Jeff Weintraub has this piece for us about his father's service in World War II.
My father was 18 in 1942, the year he graduated from high school and went to war. His entry in his high school yearbook features his future plans to get my hands on A. Schickelgruber, which for years was understood to be Hitler's real name until it was later determined that Hitler, in fact, was always Hitler. So from the Bronx to Great Britain with the Third Army and across France in an artillery battery went the highly motivated member of the class of 42, with stops for basic training in the Deep South that left my father with a lifelong hatred of country music and a grudging but unwavering respect for the melting pot. Like many, I suppose, he never talked about combat or really any part of his war experience, save for one incident he mentioned when someone asked him whether he was ever scared during the war. Yes, he said, many times. The story he chose to tell, however, occurred when combat had all but ended, when a German civilian reported to the command of the American occupying forces that she had been raped by a GI in my father's battery. The battery was mustered for inspection, and officers led the civilian slowly through the ranks to identify her assailant. My father recalled her deliberate walk up one line and down another, and especially the unremote possibility of misidentification, with a court-martial and a firing squad hanging in the balance. It was, he said, as frightening a moment as any he encountered throughout his tour of duty. He did not recall whether the German civilian identified anyone, just the fear that having survived everything else, a possibility still remained he might not get to go home. But he soon did, though for an operation that ultimately left him sightless in his right eye. He was nevertheless slated to join the expeditionary force following his convalescence that was being readied for the invasion of the Japanese homeland, where, as we know, casualties were expected to be very, very high. As we also know, Truman decided instead to drop the bomb and spared the troops, and 4 years later, I was born. I've gotten quite a headache trying to reconcile my existence, and my son's existence, with that decision to exterminate innocent men, women, and children on the other side of the planet so that others might live. I've never had to confront the question of the ultimate sacrifice, never had to face a decision to risk my life for my country. But that's the goal of civilization, isn't it? To strive to keep its people safe and free from terrors. Many people of my generation have had, in any event, a peculiar relationship with all things military. While our fathers and our mothers lived their salad days inside a great mission that defined them throughout their lives, our war, Vietnam, was the first conflict subject to mass public opposition, even open resistance, that ended not in victory, but exhaustion. We conflated our disdain for the war and the powers that led and kept us there with condemnation of the soldiers who were fighting. Insofar as we remained then and continue to remain safe and aloof while others in essence did and continue to do the dirty work, the price has been a societal fissure that's come to symbolize all the things we've come to believe divide us. I've been to Gettysburg with its places of terrible sacrifice such as Devil's Den and Cemetery Ridge, sites of a vicious crossfire and a desperate charge, hard by the storied cemetery that Lincoln famously consecrated in the name of higher purpose, and felt the weight of history. But last month my wife and son and I took a vacation in France, and I for one was not prepared for the emotional impact of the Normandy beaches. Standing on the vastness of Omaha Beach, for example, with only the sky for cover, and in the clear sight of bluffs from which hell rained down, the notion of fighting and dying for your country lost some of its theoretical character. The American cemetery above Omaha Beach is on a beautiful plot of land donated by France, an immaculate emerald expanse lined with native trees. The 9,000 grave markers are laid out with such precision that every single perspective yields a view of an unbroken line, no one grave standing out, an absolute equality of honor and purpose. The neighboring museum leans heavily on biography to tell the story of Operation Overlord by leading with portraits of the all-too-brief lives of some of those who perished. Acts of heroism perhaps known only to a few. Careers that were interrupted or future plans that were never realized, or the families who have endured their absence, or just their names. We left that day most mindful not of the grandeur of the ambition and the remarkable military accomplishment of the landing itself, but rather of the atomic level of war, the individual soldier on the knife edge. My father lost a favorite cousin on D-Day, an airman missing in action. When The Longest Day was released in 1962, the war movie to end all war movies, 3 hours, the invasion soup to nuts, Fonda, Mitchum, and John Wayne leading an army that emptied the 20th Century Fox lots. My father, of course, went to see it, and see it again, and again, and again. Just about every night during its local run, more than 10 times, I think. As actual footage from the invasion was mixed into the recreation, he had hoped to catch a glimpse of his cousin he lost 18 years ago on that longest day. Today, of course, you could pop in a DVD and save your money and your time. But I don't think he cared about either money or time. Rather, I think the movie presented an opportunity to sit alone in the dark with memories he could not share. He did say once that the war was the great adventure of his lifetime, and that nothing else ever quite measured up.
Thanks to Jeff Weintraub for that, and to Matthew Miltich, Nita Norden, Susan Hawkinson, Robert Jevney, Sue Searing, and Caleb Leinbach for sharing their stories with us this hour. I'm Michael Goldberg, and I'll be back this time next week with Stay Human. I spent an afternoon last month immersed in the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. I'd never been, though a number of friends had recommended it. 5 enormous cement pavilions, housing everything from B-52s and submarines to letters home and worn-down boots. The sidewalks outside and between the buildings are paved with stones, each bearing the name, rank, and year of birth, year of death of someone who served from 1940 to 45. It felt really strange walking on those names. I stopped frequently to read a few more. It was just too hard to walk on the stones thinking about my destination instead of theirs. I spoke with someone who had worked at the museum since it opened early in this century. At that time, of all the servicemen and women from World War II, about a third were still living, he said, and he missed the veterans of that generation now. He'd made a lot of friends, and those vets contributed in 1,000 ways to the museum's growth and programs. My dad turned 18 a few days after Pearl Harbor. It would have been amazing to go through this place with him. He would have loved it. He would have had some comment, often some history lesson to share at every stop. Even without his running commentary, I would guess it'd take about 20 hours or more to fully absorb every exhibit. I skimmed a few and never even made it to the Pacific Theater. I had never realized before that just days before Pearl Harbor, a vast majority of Americans opposed engaging in a war against Germany. Big demonstrations, mothers carrying signs saying, "We remember the last war." It reminded me that majority opinion sometimes is just froth on a churning sea. We seek to shape events, but are more likely shaped by them. Exhibits in the building called the Arsenal of Democracy, devoted to the home front, do not shy away from the America First movement or the boatloads of Jewish refugees turned away, Japanese Americans in concentration camps, African Americans, the army segregated, the dying integrated, returning to fight for democracy after they got home. but it was in the building with detailed explications of campaigns and battles, North Africa, Sicily, France, Germany, that I really got lost, in many senses of that word. So many days, weeks, months, such impossible conditions, so many deaths numbered. Often the wall plaques beside the maps and other exhibits used phrases like, the Allies had miscalculated about. The generals didn't realize that, despite the eventual taking of the town, it served no strategic purpose because I tried but failed to grasp the scale of the thing or the mud-soaked reality of a single soldier. And I tried but failed to understand what it would really mean, not just with words, really mean to honor their sacrifice. Like I say, I got lost. Think of all the war memorials and monuments and museums all over the country, all over the world. What will they say at the end of this century about the endless war in Afghanistan, the global refugee crisis, the first modern war not started by a nation but by a private corporation, Osama bin Laden's global business? One thing I keep relearning about history is at every given moment, nobody, not the privates, not the generals, not the insiders or the rest of us, nobody knows what's really going on or what happens next. And whatever does, it will be turned into a story told by people who weren't there and whose own grandchildren will turn it into a different story, apply their own meaning to the past. And always there will be those who have fallen, stones beneath our feet, their stories now ours to tell.
I was an army mechanic. I worked with the men. I worked on my back. I tried to fit in. Torque wrenches and ratchets, multimeters and scale, grease on my face, grease on my hands, grease under my nails, and it was so hard to see till it attacked. My enemy wasn't Iraq. Soldiers bartered and traded. That's the way our world worked. Trading favors for favors. In the sand and the dirt. I stood my ground.